13. Fake blood and Opie shaming. I will forever owe a debt to Opie Taylor. The experience of inhabiting that character, walking a mile in his keds, defined my early life. But being associated with Opie didn't serve me particularly well in adolescence, especially an adolescence whose kickoff happened to coincide with the summer of love. I didn't really do the 60s. I loved the Beatles, still do, and approvingly noted the rise of my female classmates' hemlines. But I was never a part of the drug culture, never had long hair, and never participated in political protests, though I often sympathized with their aims. I was the son of an Oklahoma farm boy whose 1930s childhood wasn't that different from an 1890s childhood, and I was on a TV show set in the 1960s that, for all intents and purposes, really took place in the 1940s. With my freckles and prominent ears, I looked uncannily like one of those kids who modeled for Norman Rockwell when he was painting covers for the Saturday Evening Post during World War II. By accident more than design, I lived at a remove from the era in which I grew up. But the 60s proceeded nonetheless. David Starr Jordan Middle School went up to 9th grade, so when the Andy Griffith Show wrapped its 7th season, I was anxious about my re-entry into the school system. Justifiably so, it turned out. On my first day of junior high in February 1967, I was in culture shock. Some of the 9th graders were old, as in 15, and had long hair and mutton chop sideburns. My reputation as Opie preceded me, and wandering through the halls that day, I felt eyes boring into me from every direction. Meanwhile, my own POV seemed distorted, like I was looking out at everyone else through a fisheye lens, with myriad faces poking grotesquely into my view. Some super sideburned kid who was already 6 feet tall and as burly as a linebacker leaned into me and said, "Hey, Opium, you want to buy a lid?" I wasn't fluent in his terminology, but I knew that it had something to do with illegal drugs and was meant to intimidate me. Fortunately, there was a safe harbor of my friend Noel and the game of basketball. Noel invited me to join him in a pickup game of hoops during lunch break. I was in my element, hitting one shot after another, regaining my confidence. But then I noticed that some of the spectators, girls no less, were pointing at my groin and laughing at me. I glanced down. The zipper to my jeans was completely unzipped. I blushed inwardly, but I did not want to give anyone the satisfaction of showing how embarrassed I was. So I acted like nothing was wrong, made no effort to zip up, and simply continued playing. After the game was over, and I had discreetly rectified the situation, a 9th grade girl waved me over to where she and some of her classmates were standing. She was wearing a very short skirt. She raised her leg up on a step, motioning to her bare inner thigh, and said, "Hey, Opie, will you sign my leg?" Total internal panic. I don't think she was coming on to me, but instead using her power as an older, popular girl to fluster me. She succeeded. I stammered, no, I'm not going to sign your leg," and scampered away. I survived that day and actually had a fine time at Jordan over the next 3 years with lots of friends and basketball teammates who liked me for who I was. But right to the end of my public school education in Burbank, which concluded at John Burroughs High School, I was dogged by what today might be called Opie shaming. The desire among my peers to get under my skin by taunting me as Opie rather than treating me as Ron. My father's choice to train me to fight proved justified. Though I renounced violence in middle school, I benefited from toughening up. By my senior year, I had grown into a confident young man with a girlfriend, more on her later, and a C on my letterman's jacket because I had been named a co-captain of the Burroughs Varsity B team. I was too short and just not skilled enough for the Varsity A team. My name sometimes got published in the local paper, the Burbank Daily Review, not because of my acting work, but because I had scored more than 10 points in a game. That felt great, and the Opie shaming had completely dissipated on my home court at Burroughs. But at an away game that final season, the opposing team's fans were out for blood. Every time I went to the line to shoot free throws, their band tried to psych me out by playing an abrasive, mocking version of the Andy Griffith Show's theme song. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. This was punctuated by a chant of, "Miss it, Opie! Miss it, Opie!" I nevertheless hit 5 of my 6 free throws in that game. But I can't pretend that those kids' taunts didn't affect me. They pissed me off. The word that I would use now, which I didn't know then, is reductive. I resented that these mean-spirited teens were publicly mocking and ridiculing me for a role that I had played, and I resented the corresponding insinuations that I must be a pampered TV star, a lame-ass wimp. I've had a complicated relationship with that famous whistled theme song. By and large, I regard it positively. It evokes fond memories of Andy's warmth and the joy that we took in working together. But there were times in my life when that damned song was the bane of my existence. I'd be in a public place, ball cap pulled low, calling no attention to myself, when I'd hear a faint version of the tune tootling from somebody's lips. And that's when I'd know that I had been made. In school, I would sometimes be at my locker, minding my own business, trying to find a homework assignment that I had misplaced, when behind me, I'd hear whistling along with derisive laughter. And that's when I knew I was being mocked for some jerk's amusement. For all the aggravation that being Opie had occasionally caused me, I was devastated when the Andy Griffith Show came to an end. Truthfully, I knew that the finish line was in sight at the conclusion of the 5th season when Don Knotts announced that he was leaving to make movies. Andy soldiered on for 3 more seasons, and they were good seasons, but it was apparent to everyone on set that he wasn't having as much fun without Don. So when the show wrapped its 8th and final season in 1968, it was downright destabilizing. We were going out on top, literally. The 67-68 season was the first in which we were the number one show in the Nielsen ratings, drawing 35 million viewers a week. Some of my castmates, such as Francis Bavier and George Lindsay, were going to continue on with the Griffith Show's sequel series, Mayberry RFD, in which Ken Berry took over the lead role. But I would not be joining them. The producers had offered me a reduced role in the new series as a semi-regular, but this excited neither me nor my parents. If Andy wasn't going to be in it, I wasn't going to be either. I passed. We had a big wrap party at Desilu to celebrate the end of our show's massively successful run. CBS pulled out all the stops, catering the affair, and hiring Andy's favorite swing band, Les Brown and his band of renown. All the men and women with whom I had worked since the age of 6 in front of and behind the camera were there. I was 14 and determined not to cry. Then Andy announced through a microphone that he wanted to speak. "I want to thank y'all for your good work," he said. "You didn't just make a successful TV show. You brought the town of Mayberry to life. In doing that, you brought my childhood to life again, week after week. I can't tell you what that means to me." At this, I started to lose the emotional battle. Andy's words jolted me, making me recognize something I had not yet come to terms with. My boyhood had taken place here, on this soundstage. Now, it was coming to an end, or at least a major chapter of it. I realized that I would never again see these familiar faces on a regular basis. I lost it. I started weeping inconsolably in front of everyone. It was so embarrassing. Fortunately, my mom was there to help me put things in perspective. "My emotions," she said, "were a recognition of what the show and all its people had meant to me. But this moment also represented a new beginning, a door opening to the next phase of my life, which was full of promise. This Mother Knows Best moment calmed me and allowed me to enjoy the party at least a little." Ninth grade marked the first time in my life where I was a student for pretty much the whole school year. I was called into a meeting with my guidance counselor, Mr. Sira, to discuss my future. He asked me if I wanted to go to college, and I replied in the affirmative. "Then I don't think you should act anymore," Mr. Sira said. "Based on the grades and test scores you have now, you're not on a college track. So let's think about giving up the acting and working on school." I did not appreciate what I perceived to be his condescension, but I held my tongue. It's true, I had been a mediocre student for most of my childhood, but I made plain to Mr. Sira that I had no intention of stopping acting. Then, I doubled down on schoolwork, studied harder, and got straight A's for the first time in my life. I sure showed that Mr. Sira, which I realize now is exactly what he wanted me to do.
When we came back for season 2 of Gentle Ben, we had every reason to believe that our show was going to be around for a while. We had a major sponsor in the Eastman Kodak Company, which took out a huge ad for us in New York's Grand Central Station, a backlit cast photo 60 feet wide by 18 feet high that used Kodak's Colorama technology. There was more money in the shooting budget, we had better production values, and most of all, we had momentum. But by the spring of 69, after just 2 seasons, I was, like Ron, a boy without a series. Shooting the second season had been a great experience for me. I became a better actor and spent more time operating the airboat. We even recorded a Gentle Ben cast album, The Bare Facts, that was slated for release at the season's end. A hippie vocal group called the Good Time People backed us. I performed a spoken word version of the show's theme song, which to that point had no lyrics, entitled I Am the Way I Am. Dennis Weaver sang a psychedelic song called Cobwebs of Your Mind. Dad did a goofy novelty song called Don't Cry, Little Gator. And he and I performed together my favorite of all the songs, a wiggy duet entitled What's a Whatchamacallit? Alas, we slipped badly in the ratings. Disney made a point of knocking us off. We had caught them with their pants down when we became a hit, so the second time around, they upped the ante, supplying Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color with higher-grade programming. This was also the beginning of the rural purge era, when CBS canned a bunch of shows despite their good ratings because they didn't reach the urban, high-spending demographic that advertisers coveted. So that meant the end of Green Acres, Petticoat Junction, and the Beverly Hillbillies. We weren't a broad comedy like those shows, but we were decidedly unhip and no longer a part of CBS's future plans. They were moving in a more provocative, socially conscious direction, with such programs as All in the Family and MASH. We had wrapped the second season thinking that we would head back to Florida in due time. The network had scheduled an in-store appearance by the cast at the new Tower Records shop on Sunset Boulevard in L.A. to promote The Bare Facts. But the album never went on sale. It was hastily withdrawn from circulation and is now a collector's item that can be found only on eBay. I was out in the backyard playing basketball one day during hiatus when I heard the phone ring in Dad's office. A few minutes later, he beckoned me up the stairs. With a solemn look on his face, Dad said, "We're not going back to Florida, Clint. CBS decided to pull the plug." I was confused but not devastated. I was 10 years old and had already contemplated what it would be like if I worked on Gentle Ben all the way to age 14, as Ron did on The Andy Griffith Show. The more I processed this, the more I believed that I would look pretty silly pulling a bear's chain as a teenager. I was accustomed to looking forward and moving on. I simply went back to a routine with which I was already familiar. Auditions, scoring one-episode guest shots, running lines with Dad in the evening, and driving over the hills into Hollywood to shoot the next morning. Staying in Burbank also allowed me to focus on my passions, sports writing and baseball. I pivoted to banging away on a typewriter and perfecting my curveball. I never saw Bruno again in person. Or in Bear, I should say. But it made me happy when a few years later, I was watching John Huston's movie, The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, in a theater and saw Bruno up on the screen performing opposite Paul Newman. Every bear has a unique look, and I had become good at distinguishing one from another. I recognized Bruno instantly and felt a pang of pride for my guy.
I quickly discovered that I had overestimated the demand for my services as an actor. There was no Opie bounce, no clamoring by the networks and the studios to get their mitts on the kid from the Andy Griffith Show. The work I was getting was pretty underwhelming. A Disney TV movie. Yes, broadcast as part of the Wonderful World series that knocked off Gentle Ben. And guest shots on such long-running shows as Lassie, The FBI, and Daniel Boone, as well as the fleetingly popular of their time shows, Land of the Giants, Lancer, and Judd for the Defense. These parts were perfectly fine as jobs, but sobering as my new reality, in that I received no special billing or higher pay for being a household name. I fared no better in the film world. I didn't come close to landing a part in any of the prestigious movies that I auditioned for, which included Bless the Beasts and the Children, A Separate Piece, and The Last Picture Show. I didn't mind that I no longer had a regular gig because I was, after all, a teenager in high school. I was absorbed in sports and the pursuit of girls, and I enjoyed the novelty of being able to spend an entire school year in school with my classmates. But it stung to realize that the TV and motion picture industry, which I had grown up viewing as a reliable source of validation, affirmation, and employment, did not believe that it owed me anything. It was not invested in my material comfort or emotional well-being. Right after Andy Griffith, I had the audacity to turn down one-off parts in Bonanza and The Mod Squad because I had made a commitment to the school basketball program that I had to keep if I wanted to play. I somewhat smugly assumed that the industry would always be eager to take me back. It wasn't. To some degree, the industry is set up to fail and destabilize child actors. They're in demand when they're prepubescent and cute, but less so as they enter adolescence, just as these kids are entering the most vulnerable years of their childhoods, self-aware, awkward, and hormonal. Their livelihood and sense of identity are pulled out from under them. This naturally only compounds the feelings of frustration and inadequacy that all kids experience as they go through puberty. And don't think that it's easy to simply sit tight until your voice has changed and you can start playing teenagers. You may be 15, but you're still a minor, bud. And the studios have a lot of 20-something actors at their disposal who can pass for teens and aren't required to have school breaks, guardians, or curtailed working hours. So your phone stops ringing. For the first time, I began to understand from lived experience the psychological burden that my father carried from month to month, staring at that silent phone in hope and frustration. It's hard not to take this rejection personally.
I didn't turn down my shot to be on Mod Squad. Dad and I jumped at the opportunity for me to play a little boy who was kidnapped and rescued by Link, played by the prodigiously afroed Clarence Williams III. It was a memorable gig for me. We filmed my scenes the morning of the 1971 Sylmar earthquake, the first that I'd ever lived through. It tossed me out of bed at 6 a.m. The next thing I knew, I was in the hallway, and Dad was running towards me stark naked, having bounded up the stairs to hustle Ron and me to safety. The telephone lines were knocked out, and I presumed that we would not be filming that day. But Dad said that we had a responsibility to show up for work. Sure enough, the rest of the cast and crew had assembled at the Paramount lot. We worked the whole day, with people checking their transistor radios to find out the fate of their neighborhoods. My acting career was still going great guns. I found a welcoming home on the westerns that survived into the turn of the decade, such as Gunsmoke, The Virginian, and Lancer. And I was getting sitcom work, too. One night, in fact, I was on two of them the same evening, as the jerk who tormented Johnny Whitaker in an episode of Family Affair on CBS, and as Felix Unger's would-be protege in an episode of The Odd Couple on ABC. The premise was that Felix had joined the Big Brothers program, and I was the kid he was assigned to mentor. The complication, true to life, was that I preferred to hang out with his roommate, the sports writer Oscar Madison. My dad was so thrilled by my double occupancy in prime time that Thursday that he took out an ad in the trades with a big photo of my chubby-cheeked mug. Clint Howard, guest stars, as a bully, on Family Affair, tonight, 7:30, CBS. And then swing back to a nice, likable kid with a problem on Odd Couple, tonight, 9:30, ABC. The name of my agent, Marguerite Ogg, was helpfully offered at the bottom of the ad. The trade magazines were a serious force, read by every decision maker in our industry, so this was a big deal. And Dad's strategy worked. I kept getting parts in good TV shows. Marcus Welby, M.D., Night Gallery, Nanny and the Professor, The Streets of San Francisco. Puberty had not hit me yet, and no doors were slamming in my face. But it was only a matter of time before I would go through the same thing that Ron did.
One saving grace of this unsettling period is that it coincided with a great era in filmmaking. I was able to catch a new wave of American directors asserting itself. Mike Nichols, The Graduate, Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, William Friedkin's The Boys in the Band, Robert Altman's MASH. I took them all in with Dad. From a storytelling perspective, movies worked differently than TV. Whereas The Andy Griffith Show earned its viewers' interest and built long-term loyalty through simple stories and deep, cumulative character development, these films were rigorously planned to transport their audience in a single, immersive viewing. Dad was permissive about what I watched. Some of these movies were explicit in their depictions of violence and sexuality. Andy Griffith was mildly scandalized when, in our show's later years, I told him that I had seen Bonnie and Clyde with my father one weekend. But Dad thought that my viewing such pictures would be useful in my maturation process as an actor, aspiring filmmaker, and young man. I wasn't one of those kids who cringed at watching a sex scene while seated next to his father. I knew what movies were, art created through illusion. And Dad knew that I knew. These excursions to the movies became a nice way for us to hang out and talk about life in general, not just storytelling and filmmaking. I also got into the great anti-hero movies of the time, such as Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. And I loved the exploitation flicks that Roger Corman churned out by the bushel through his New World Pictures production company. Dad and Ho Cal actually wrote a script tailored to Corman's sensibilities called Arkansas Wipeout, in which a pair of country boy moonshiners outwitted some stuck-up city sophisticates. Corman didn't go for it, but this shows you how aligned Dad and I were in our tastes. I lost myself in movies and became an ever more dedicated student of them. In that pre-streaming, pre-cable, pre-VCR era, I was a particularly avid watcher of Million Dollar Movie, a syndicated program that over the course of a week ran the same vintage movie over and over, like a repertory cinema house. This allowed me to study King Kong, the 1933 original, Damn Yankees, and The Time Machine, the way that Egyptologists study hieroglyphs, decoding them and breaking them down into their component parts. I was on my third viewing of Henry Levin's 1959 movie, Journey to the Center of the Earth, that I first stumbled upon an exercise I still use today. I had left the living room with the TV's sound turned low, and when I returned for the exciting conclusion that the program's announcer always promised, I came upon my favorite action sequence, in which the protagonists encounter a convincingly real-looking Dimetrodon dinosaur. I had long wondered how the filmmakers pulled this off. With the sound down, I could more easily decode the techniques and effects at work. I noticed that the monstrous dinosaur was actually an iguana of some kind with a spine sail glued to its back. I figured out that the ruins of Atlantis were really carefully rendered matte paintings. I identified the camera setups that the filmmakers used to stage the sequence and make the audience believe every second of it. Thereafter, I lowered the sound whenever there was a scene I wanted to study closely. With my own money, I bought a Bauer Super 8 camera, intent on putting my newly accumulated filmmaking knowledge to use. I would make a Peckinpah-style splatter pick with a few Old West nods to Leone and a killer title: Cards, Cads, Guns, Gore, and Death. The plot of this two-minute silent masterpiece in the making was simple. Three cowboys are playing poker in a dusty saloon. One takes exception to the other's winning hand and shoots the winner dead. Then the third guy shoots the shooter dead. The fourth guy, the sheriff, comes upon the scene and shoots the third guy from behind, killing him. Then he shakes his head in disgust, lamenting the waste of it all. The end. That was the easy part. The hard part was authentically portraying the carnage on a non-existent budget. In my curiosity about filmmaking, I took to bending the ears of everyone within a specialized job on the sets I worked on. A special effects guy gave me the intel on how they did gunshot wounds in Bonnie and Clyde and The Wild Bunch. They put a patch of leather on the bare skin of an actor, he said, and on top of that, a steel plate. They wired a small electrical charge to the plate and fed the wire down through the actor's shirt and pant leg. The length of wire that trailed out of the actor's pants was buried in the dirt so the camera wouldn't pick it up. Then they put a little balloon-like blood packet on top of the plate and made a small, unnoticeable tear in the actor's shirt where the packet was so that when the effects guy sent a current through the charge, the shirt would give when the packet exploded. Result? A convincing splatter. I had neither the pyrotechnic equipment to duplicate this system, nor the capability to try anything involving wires without electrocuting myself. So I worked out an alternative. Clint and I had a Mattel Switch and Go, a really cool set of battle tanks that came with an air pump and slender, flexible yellow tubes. The tubes, when hooked up to the pump, allowed us to fire little plastic missiles from the tanks. I rigged up a system in which I fed watered-down ketchup into the tubes and then concealed them under the actors' shirts. The other end of the tube was attached to a bicycle pump, which, if you slammed it down hard, would sorta, kinda spurt out the ketchup solution in a gory fashion. All good. But I still needed actors to play my violent, doomed cowboys. Guess who I called upon?
Yep, big surprise. I reported for duty, the Robert De Niro to Ron's Martin Scorsese. I played card player number 3, the one who got shot in the back. My friend Scott Green manned the bicycle pump. His brother, Steve, played the sheriff. The other two card players were Hoke Howe's sons, Scott and Stark. Dad sometimes included me with his movie-going outings with Ron. When we went to see The Wild Bunch, I witnessed in real time the idea for Ron's splatter pick sparking in his brain. An expression of excitement came over his face. At home, I helped him work through the logistics of using tubes and the pump. Then we scrounged up hats, bandanas, ponchos, and sunglasses so that the card players looked convincingly outlaw-like. But our attempts at authentic period costuming were compromised by budget constraints. We all wore white t-shirts because we needed cheap clothes that we could sacrifice to the ketchup-stained gods. Cards, Cads, Guns, Gore, and Death is a good piece of guerrilla filmmaking. Ron's opening shot is an impressive piece of camera work. Starting close on a pile of poker chips, Ron then pulled back and followed the action from player to player. It's like a kid's version of the crane shot that opens Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. And the splatters turned out really well. We nailed the gore and death part. I sometimes grumbled about being in Ron's little movie projects because I'd grown accustomed to getting paid to act, and I wanted to play with my friends. Still, these were good times. I have since worked with 100 adult directors who couldn't hold a candle to the 16-year-old Ron Howard. I could see that he had the goods, a knowledge of camera angles, the discipline to light scenes correctly, a facility for directing his actors. In some regards, nothing has really changed. I'm still acting in Ron Howard's movies with a full understanding that he's the general and I'm a private. I have my opinions on how I would do a scene, but ultimately you do what the director says. That's part of the discipline that Dad taught us. It was during this time that Ron decided that he wanted to be called Ron instead of Ronnie. Actually, he decided initially that his directorial name would be Ron Howard with two N's. However the hell he wanted to spell it, I respected his choice. Being called Opie all the time was one of the worst things he had to endure as a kid. I thought that Ron looked weird in the credits, but he wanted to shed his little kid image, so I fully supported him.
I tried on a few different identities. One was Ron spelled R-O-N-N, Howard, and another was R-W, Howard. My middle name is William, and R.W., to my young mind, sounded directorial and authoritative, like D.W. Griffith. I was also worried that my Andy Griffith Show identity as Ronnie Howard might work against me in terms of being taken seriously. I had a lot of time to think about this. The 4 years between the conclusion of the Andy Griffith Show and my next big break, a part in American Graffiti, are a fraction of my life, but they seem to go on forever at the time. I was experiencing an adolescent identity crisis that was typical in many respects, but atypical in its somewhat public nature and its implications for my career. Fortunately, a job came along in this period that really helped me sort myself out. It's not one that most people know about, a G-rated Disney picture called The Wild Country. But it meant a hell of a lot to me, not least because it marked the only time that Clint and I got to act together as brothers while playing brothers.